You're listening to Wins Above Fantasy, part of the Pitcherless Podcast Network with Van Burnett and Steve Gisuelli.
Welcome back, everybody. It is Wins Above Fantasy, episode 186. I'm Van Burnett, joined as always by Steve Gisuelli. We got a fun show ahead here. The Pitcherless mock draft for 2026 is underway. And Steve, we are looking at draft landscape and our early takeaways of what a draft board looks like. It is the official, blank slate horizon for next year. And it is always like, the earliest moment where you kind of look at everything and you're like, oh, this is what the draft is going to look like. Some of these names we've been talking about all year, and you have these questions of kind of how early will people go, how late people will fall, position scarcity. So super fun topic. Excited to be here chatting. I'm on the road, so for those of you guys on the YouTube, pardon the Kansas City hotel. But Steve, it's great dialing in and talking baseball. How's it going, man?
Yeah, it's great. This has been a ton of fun. Nick Pollock does a great job organizing this. We've done it, I think, 3 or 4 years now. I know we used to do like mock drafts, like, that weren't official podcast mock drafts, but this podcast mock draft is something that Nick gets started basically like the day the season ends. It's all the podcast hosts from the great network that we have here. And everyone takes it very seriously. You know, sometimes mock drafts can kind of, not that people don't put in effort, but this is taken as seriously as you can a mock draft. So,
because you got to answer.
It's appreciated and
with
yeah
Nick.
And yeah and it's fun to talk about across the network, and people use it for content as we're doing right now. We'll each have our show, each podcast will have a show with Nick, so be on the lookout for that. You and I will join him at some point, I'm sure, as soon as this wraps up. It's fun. It's a super cool thing to do, and there's so many questions that we have. It's like, how high is Junior Caminero going to go? First round, second round? Well, we got that question answered. We'll get into that a little bit. And there's just other things that come to shape that, we could ask ourselves these questions and ponder between the two of us. Hey, what do you think about this for next year as when we're in September? But when there's, 12, 14 people, whatever else it is with co-managers and all that, taking this very seriously, you get those questions answered quickly. Like, is there going to be a discount on Acuna? No, not really. Like, what about, Tatis? You kind of had a down year power-wise. Well, no. People still believe in him, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Where does Raleigh go? Those are all things we'll get into, but it's fun to get those answered in the sense. And, I know that all off-season will quote NFBC ADP, and rightfully so. I mean, there's value to it. I know we try to shy away from it from time to time just because it's not the most popular popular platform that people play on, despite it seeming that way on Twitter. And I'm not trying to take a dig at it or anything. Like, there are the values to it. It's the high stakes of high stakes, right? Like, that's where, if you want to play competitive fantasy baseball, that's where you go, and there's value to it. But most people don't play like that. This is a 12-team Yahoo League, like the most common format that people play fantasy baseball at. And there's really not much of that as far as ADP. So this is a really useful tool early on as you start to prep for drafts, which are coming up quickly. Like, it's basically the playoffs. And then once you see November come around, like, people are just drafting. You'll see a bunch of draft boards. You'll see them all throughout December. And then January now is like when it gets super, super busy. So it's right around the corner. To have this as a reference this early on is invaluable in my mind. So glad we did it. Excited to discuss it.
Yeah. And I guess housekeeping, we are currently in the middle of the 14th round. Yeah. And it's a 12-team Yahoo eligibility, two Otanis, all that good stuff. And we had draft slot number 5. So I think that's another some fodder for us to chat about. But Steve, I think earliest thing you do is you look at the first round and the top of the first round, and Judge and Otani are up there, which is exactly like last year, and rightfully so. I think that's also maybe the first time in a few years that it's kind of been that chalky at the very top. Would you agree with that?
It's kind of since Trout, right? Like, you know, Trout had that run of, you know, you prayed to get the first pick and take Trout and have that opportunity for whatever, you know, 8 to 10 years, right? I remember writing an article about that when he finally fell below ADP one, like
it was
four
Trey
or
Turner.
5 years ago.
I think it became Trey Turner, and then it was like Acuna, and now it's kind of cool to see that Judge and Ohtani are kind of sharing this peak together with like back to back, you know. So that I think is a cool early observation. Bobby Witt, for all kind of the you know, ups and downs, and what we, you know, we thought maybe we could see a 1-1 season from Witt, and he still ended up great. So Bobby Witt stays in the top four. I think maybe the biggest change is when you look at Soto, who jumped from, I think last year he was 8, 9, 10 in that territory. Soto goes up to 3. So we'll probably do a whole episode that just hits on the first round, right? So we don't want to spend tons of time here, but Steve, I'll let you talk about the biggest surprise of the first round, which had a little pop. You want to talk about that one?
Yeah. I mean, maybe I was definitely surprised, maybe less surprised than others. We went Jose Ramirez at 5. And then the next pick, our fearless leader, Nick Pollock, went Junior Caminero. And I don't hate it. I don't know if I would have made that pick. I think I prefer Carroll. I might prefer Ellie, but I could see not by much. Julio too, I could have a good argument, but I really don't see many others, you know, even Acuna, but I would definitely take Caminero, I think, before Tatis. Just that raw power, and I think there's average upside. Like, his BABIP was super low. Like, he, you know, people talk about the home road splits, and especially considering Caminero played half of his games in Tampa Bay, where it had Yankee Stadium dimensions, and on nights when the wind was blowing out, it was by far like the most hitter friendly park in the majors. Down in the Big Stein in Tampa, that George M. Steinbrenner Field. He won't have that next year. They're going to go back to the Trop. I really don't ding him that much for it. I still project Caminero as a 280, 35 to 40 homer guy with, you know, 100 runs, 100 RBI type of player. Like, that's what I view him as. Sure, you know, maybe this was on the high end of homers at 46 and he got a few extra because of Tropicana, but his BABIP on the road was like 120. Like, it's not going to stay like that. And for a guy that has this much power, doesn't strike out, like, the only thing is you're not getting the steals, and that's not as big a deal in a head-to-head league. Like, he's not going to go here in NFBC in their standard 5x5 roto. He's just not, because there's no steals there. But I think he'll go late first, early second, just because that's kind of where guys that are four-category studs go, and that's what I think Caminero is.
Yeah. Interesting to hear you say two. You project him at 280. Were you just tossing that out because he hit 264? The XBA was at 270. Like, that's in the range for sure.
I think because he hits the ball so hard, doesn't strike out. Like, true. I think average is a plus tool for him. I don't think it's something that should be average at best, right? Like, you know, he struck out 19% of the time. And had a 260 BABIP with a hard hit percentage of 51.4. Like,
yeah, that's a great point.
You know, the XBA was, you know, 275. That's in good line, sort of with what I expect. But I think there could be better years. As this, I think, was more of like, hey, probably got a little bit unlucky as far as, you know, balls falling and things like that.
Yeah, yeah, just 22 years old. So, yeah, Caminero, and even the crazy, seven steals
crazy
is kind
good
of chipping
year
in
for how it's, young
yeah,
he was.
Incredible. Yeah. So, yeah, that was a big surprise. You mentioned some of the other names, Acuna and Tatis at the back end of the first round, and then Tarek Skubal goes at the very end. Paul Skeens was a couple picks after him. So I guess that's where you go next on draft landscape, as you always want to look at what's happening with pitchers. So in this draft, we saw four starting pitchers go in the first three rounds. I pulled up last year's as well, Steve, just to get a side-by-side throughout this podcast. But coincidentally, the same amount, four pitchers went in the first three rounds last year. So that is pretty similar. Of course, a couple of the names changed. Skubal and Skeens were the consistent ones. I believe Crochet might have been in there as well.
Yeah, I think he was SP3, right? Was he?
I think that sounds right. He was definitely in the top four, though. And then Eno Saris went with Hunter Brown with the first pick in the third round, and that was the
first,
only
pick. Like, who's going to be four? Yeah, I think that's a, like, we have a question, and I want to ask this to you. Like, who are you taking of these three? Because I think you could take, I would argue for any one of them, one. I know Nick has Crochet one on his early list. But I think the biggest question after those three is, okay, who's number four? And you know what, Brown. And then there was a pretty big gap to five, right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and I think that's what, I mean, spoiler alert, we jumped in on starting pitcher in the fourth round, which is earlier than we have done, I think, since we've done this exercise, Steve. And we went Brian Wu, and I think that's just, I guess to go back to the numbers a little bit, after the first four pitchers went in the first three rounds, nine starting pitchers went in the next two rounds. Last year, that was three more than last year. So I think there is a little bit of, like, maybe a little bit of a premium push up rather than last year. There was such a major, like, good glob from pick 80 to 100, 110 that maybe people are kind of prioritizing. But we jumped in on Brian Wu, and I like that. In terms of four, I got to be honest, I don't know that I have my mind up or made up yet, but it definitely feels like that's a teardrop. So I would like to be, you know, in the middle or bottom of that tier versus, like, paying first. I mean, there's
no
way that,
that's where that jump went in, right? Like, that's why there were six more pitchers taken in rounds four to six, right? And I mean, you know, this is a pitcherless draft. It's all, like, you know, every single person here fades pitching a bit, right? In these drafts, and that's kind of how it works in head to head and things like that. That this tells me that there's going to be a super high premium on starters in NFBC. Like, I think you'll see, like, that sale pick in the middle of the fifth round, right? Or sixth round. Like, that'll be probably, like, I don't know, the fourth, you know, in NFBC. They'll just be bumped up, like, because there is a pretty big tier, I think. You know, after maybe, like, Hunter Green, I think you then kind of get into, like, okay, you know, I'm pretty good with these, like, you know, Max Fried, Kirby, Peralta, Schwellenbach, Reagan. Like, I'm okay with those guys. Yeah.
Yes. I think you're going to want, I think you're going to want
Green is, like, the last one with, like, super amount of upside that could, like, strike out 13 guys in an inning, right? Like, that's kind of it. So there definitely is going
that's
to be
11.
A premium, I think.
So Green was 11. SP 11. And I think I'd agree with that, like, you definitely want one of those first 10, 12 as, like, an out-and-out ace, because those guys are rock solid. And then, like you said, you're kind of hoping that those next guys can be a viable ace, but it does feel like there's a drop-off there. How did you feel about, I know we got a section at the end to talk about our whole team, but how did you feel being one that usually waits to jump in the pool in the
fourth
round?
Because of that, I was fine. Like, you know, I think my favorite, though, and we would have got a little bit earlier, but is Yamamoto. I think I like Yamamoto. I think I'm going to have him on a lot of my teams next year. I think that's a perfect combination of floor and upside and just team contacts or wins. And, it, you know, it seems like, he, you know, the year over year improvement where, you know, I know he battled some injuries in his first year, and I think he's really becoming, you know, I don't know if he has the ability to overtake one of those three in Skubal, Skeens, or Crochet, but I think you get pretty close. I'll pitch a question right back to you. Out of those three, Scooble, Skeens, Crochet, who do you have as your number one SP? I know we normally don't dabble in that, but you never know. There's sometimes an FPC we do.
I went Scooble this year in NFBC, I have no reason to kind of waver on that. Like the 240 strikeouts, 2.21 ERA, 0.89 WHIP. Like when you see him with 13 Ks, and that, like, he just seems like he's at his absolute peak. I mean, I do think that you can make the argument for any of them, but I think I'm where this draft is, that I'm Scooble and then a slight drop, and then Skeens next, just because we haven't seen the gaudy strikeout total yet in the same way. And then Crochet, I don't know, man. I guess I'm still just like, as incredible as he was, and credit to Nick Pollock for like kind of calling out that he didn't see volume as an issue, but I got to think that 205 innings is going to be like the high watermark for him, where Scooble, it's just like,
he got more than he got more than 200 innings this year, right?
That's what I'm saying. I think this is the watermark. I think we've seen two seasons in a row with Scooble over 190 innings. I don't know.
But then there's the other side of that. It's like, all right, at what point does the volume catch up with you? You know, right? Like, how do you thread that needle?
You can make the argument whatever way. But I think I would go Scooble. Do you have a leaning right now?
My heart says Skeens. the way that, I think that just like how he's maturing and like building on, 133 innings last year, 187 innings this year, improvement in the walk rate, improvement in the swing strike rate, despite the overall K percentage going down, the just absolute amazing run prevention. Like, I think Scooble and Crochet have probably a little bit higher strikeout upside right now, but Skeens, like, for whatever reason, just does not allow runs, right? Like, he has an ERA that starts with a 1 2 years in a row. That's insane. That's unheard of. That's like Pedro Martinez run from 99 to 2000 type of thing. And I think that there is maybe it's hard to believe that you're saying this with the guy that struck out 30% of the batters he faced, but you could see sort of another step as he enters into his, age 24 season next year. He'll be 24 on May 29th. So I think I would go Skeens, but it's close. Honestly, like, if I had to, like, it's a lawyer answer, but I'd be fine with any one of those three. But give me Skeens, then maybe Crochet, and then Scooble, just because I think that Scooble's volume over the last few years sort of concerns me a little bit. Like, I think those guys are on those guys being Skeens and Crochet are kind of on the up and up, and Scooble might just tick down a little bit, just because that's sort of what happens with guys that consistently throw 200 innings. We want to get those guys that throw 200 innings, and then after they do for a bit, they break.
Scooble's not that
I'm hoping that happens or think that happens, but
he's a little bit older at 28, where Crochet's 26, Skeens, like you said, 23. But yeah, that's an embarrassment of riches up there because of how much those feel like the big three. Is there any chance that you kind of jump in on grabbing one of those guys?
If I'm in the back of the second round, I would consider that more than I have in the past. Especially if one falls, like if I'm like in the middle of the first round and one falls, maybe Crochet should have got a little bit more consideration for us when we went Gunner there, although I do love that value because I my feelings on Gunnar Henderson, despite me rostering him everywhere last year and being a bit burned. I just think he is a first round talent. But imagine getting Like Soto Crochet, that's such a good start that Nate Schwartz had there.
And then he turned around and got Marte, which we'll talk about second, how thin that is. But that's a good first three. Nice. Well, that's fun talking about pitchers there. I guess let's close the book on pitchers before we take our first break. When you look at the overall board, Steve, like, you know, we got the, for anyone on the live stream, we got it shared right now, but the dark blue is starting pitcher.
Yeah.
When you look at this beyond kind of that early first five rounds, any major takeaways? Like, you got Tyler Glass now going in the eighth round. I know we grabbed Strider in the ninth as kind of a, coincidentally, it's like where he was going last year, but he's kind of the mystery box there. You know, just the run in round eight where we saw like nine pitchers taken, that's kind of around that like pick 100 mark, which is what we saw last year. Do you see any like sweet spots in the draft or any big takeaways on pitcher beyond like pick 50?
Yeah, I like most guys that go in round 7 to 10. Like, I'm pretty good with anyone. Like, there's like, you know, Yuri Perez, like, love that. Framber Valdez, that's who we ended up as our SP2. I think we kind of went with that just because Brian Wood did have some injury concerns heading into this year, and there's a bit more floor there. You know, I know he's been on the older side and is a free agent, and that worries me a bit. But, you know, I think we could have went a little bit earlier, especially since Wu doesn't have the longest track record. Some injury history there. Right. But you know, there's other guys later that I think we can get into a little bit and, that have a ton of upside, like, you know, beyond that, right? Like Trevor Rogers as our SP4 is pretty awesome considering how good he was for you know, three quarters of this year. And I think, you know, there's upside plays too, right? Like, you know, Chase Burns, Cam Slitler, even like Jesus Luzardo was, you know, Nolan McLean. Like Jesus Luzardo had like, you know, what was he, second or third in the NL in strikeouts? Like, you know, I know the ERA was a bit high and there was that stretch where he was tipping pitches and got rocked that made his ERA look a little bit unsightly, but you know, Jesus Cesardo was one of the better pitchers 5 out of the 6 months this year, and he went in round 9. So as much as I do want to take hitters early or pitchers hitters early and maybe swaying on that just with how this draft went, there's still a lot to like in those middle rounds, as there always is in my mind. But, you know, there are landmines too. You don't know which one's going to get hurt or you know, be a bit disappointing. It's the same, but also different.
yeah, that's a good point. I think something that comes to mind to me is that it feels like last year I was really excited about pitchers from pick 150 to like 230, and I found it easy for myself to talk myself into pushing names up that I was really excited about. I think it will be the same this year because I think once you get to like the SP5 range, like, I know we talked about Gavin Williams, but some of those names aren't as like when it gets into Nick Lodolo, you know, Sandy Alcantara, Bryce Miller, Tanner Bibee, like, I could be swayed on whatever those surging pitchers are that are like,
you could talk yourself, you know, into any one of those guys is kind of what you're saying.
I'm actually saying whoever starts being the shiny toy in February with an ADP of 190, I think I might be aggressive on kind of
over
reaching sooner over some of those names that just feel a little more established. But it's an early, I mean, we're in October here, so it's just trying to.
We don't have our Ryan Weathers and Clay Holmes just yet.
Exactly.
Soon we'll get them.
Nice dig on those names. So, okay, well, we're talking more and we're talking some bats, but we're going to take our first ad break. We'll be right back after this. All right. So, Steve, to jump in on one of the biggest question mark names of the draft is, what do you do with Cal Raleigh, who is, he's just a conundrum because you look at the 60 homers. 14 steals is just absurd, but the season he put up, if you bought that 90% of it was true at the catcher position, he's a top five pick. But, you know, it's we had questions. You called those out. I think a few shows back, I was like, I think Kyle Raleigh will be a first rounder. In this draft, he actually goes second to last pick in the second round. So Hacks and Jacks.
It is a one catcher draft, one catcher.
True.
League.
Good. That's a great, great call out.
Please note that. Yeah.
But Hacks and Jacks goes Ohtani, second pick overall, and gets Kyle Raleigh at pick 23. You know, obviously the postseason he's having as well. So what's crazy is from Cal to the next catcher, it wasn't until the 10th round. Whereas last year we saw three catchers in the first seven rounds. So it's like there's a king of the mountain. And how early does he go? And then it seems like a lot of people were waiting on the depth of the position that we've talked about all year. So, yeah, just curious your thoughts on Raleigh, man. I think that I am, you know, I'm a sucker for the breakout. I think I'll be more interested in like mid-second round at least on Raleigh, even in one catcher. But talk to me what you think here.
Yeah, I don't think I'm going to have any shares. Like, I
think it's coming all the way back.
I don't know about all the way back, but even if it goes 75% of the way back, like, I don't know. Like, how high did Sal Perez go when he had his, you know, how valuable was he when he had his, whatever, what was it, 49 homer season? Like, I guess it's still really good, but I just don't see him repeating these numbers when so many of the underlying metrics were basically exactly the same year over year for Raleigh. Yeah, he pulled the ball a bit more, but you know, the hard hit percentage around the same, the strikeout rate a little bit better. Yeah, he walked a bit more, but you know, whether that's to be expected when you're hitting tanks every night, right? You know, I think that, you know, we talk about how the new swing metrics and the squared up percentage and ideal contact rate is sort of an indicator of guys that are just running hot, right? And I think that's kind of what Raleigh did just all year with that pull percentage, you know, a 25% homer on the fly ball when his career has been 19.5%. Like, I just think that there has to be some regression, and we're paying the absolute top of the market for him. You know, I just don't see him. I think he's closer to what he was in 23 and 24 than he is in 2025. And that's, you know, 35 to 40 homers, 220 average, 230 average. You know, that's a far cry from 60 and 247. I may be wrong. This may look really stupid. You know, you may do it again, but I don't know. I'm buying the longer track record rather than what seems to me to be an outlier season.
Yeah, and he's kind of, it's probably the cop out is it's probably somewhere in between, right? And that's where the ADP has him, because I think if he's a 44 home run guy and he's 235,
yeah,
at catcher, you know, beginning of the third round, end of the second, but. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a fascinating one in terms of just how he did his damage this year. Like you said, it might be more of a descriptive than a predictive, but the pull error rate went way up. And then he was pretty similar in terms of what he did on breaking pitches and off speed, but it was just fastballs. He turned from a really good or great power hitter to Babe Ruth, you know, and it's just like the 620 OP or slug. So yeah, I mean, it's a good point that a lot of the underlying
and,
stuff
and like
looks
volume could creep down a bit there too if he's not, you know, hitting home runs every 8 at-bats, 9 at-bats, right? Like he's a catcher. There's a lot of wear and tear. Like they needed his bat in the lineup every single day. If he's a 220 30 homer hitter, there's going to be more off days there. You know, he's played 159, 153 games in back-to-back seasons. I mean, these are all similar things I said to Sal Perez, and maybe it's just this but is super DH. Sal Perez. And yeah, he did DH a bunch.
He DH'd 38 games, so yeah, that's a big number. And now he's an absolute hero. And
you know, those could turn into true off days. Is sort of what my point could be, rather than, you know, them DHing if he is just a little bit worse with
cold or something. Yeah. Okay. Well, another name that is kind of, you know, new to the top two rounds is Nick Kurtz. Another just exciting thing for the future of baseball at age 22, the .290 average, 36 homers, like monster season, and the first base landscape that's looked pretty dang similar year in, year out, where we're like, oh, we want to get one of those big five guys. It's Vlad, it's Matt Olson, it's Pete Alonso, it's Freddie Freeman. Here we got Nick Kurtz as the second first baseman off the board after Vlad. And he went in the third pick of the second round. So I actually take that back. He was the first baseman even before Vlad. So what do you make of Kurtz here, Steve? Do you think this is, I guess, one, do you think it's priced appropriately? And two, do you see yourself having any shares?
Yes and yes. He is my number one first baseman. I think he's a first rounder for me. First base is sneakily tricky. I think we've kind of said that over the last few years. There's like, you know, the strikeout rate is a bit high. That is concerning, but
very high.
At 31%. So you rarely see a 31% strikeout rate with a .290 batting average. Curious, I don't have the Savant page up. What is the XBA on that?
255.
But still, the power, like, this is like, I think this is like it was Matt in 100 Olson if the breakout happened at age 22 for him.
Yeah,
right?
I should have called out it. He did all that, 36 homers and 117 games.
Yeah. 489 plate appearances and 36 homers. That's, you know, that's 50 homer. That's 50 homer pace, you know, up there with Raleigh and stuff and Judge. So, you know, the power to me is just too appealing. Sure, there's going to be some swing and miss, and I would take, you know, I'd buy closer to the XBA than the actual average. But, you know, he hits the ball so hard. The 90 runs and 86 RBIs in the 117 games, that's crazy, right? That's like 120, that's like 240 total you're looking at there in a full year. I'm very interested in Kurtz. I would take him in that range in the early second round, and he is my number one first baseman. I just am enamored by the power. Maybe there is a bit of a sophomore slump with that strikeout rate, but, you know, he didn't strike out that much in the minors. I know it was a super short stint. He was drafted in 2024, so crazy ascent to the big leagues there. But I think
do you have the K rate from
there?
The
can
minors?
Be some projection. I'll just give you the biggest sample, right? And the biggest sample was actually last year in 101 plate appearances. He struck out 26% of the time at Triple A. In 50 plate appearances in 2024, he struck out 20% of the time. He walked 24% of the time. So that's just, he was just, you know, overmatching his first year out of school, out of college. So not much of a sample to go on, but I would just project some growth in the strikeout rate there. And maybe that leaves some room for upside on what should be, you know, a .250 hitter. But I think there's more than enough power to compensate for that.
Yeah, I think it's hard to argue that another first baseman should be above him that has just that kind of mystery.
Vlad's
box.
A better real life, like all around hitter, but not right. for fantasy, right? Like we've seen too much of the mid 20 homer power seasons for
Correct.
Vlad.
Yeah, it seems intentional. Yeah. And the guys going right after Nick Kurtz in this draft were Kyle Tucker, Kyle Schwarber, Jackson Churio, Trey Turner, Gunner, Vlad, Crochet, and then Cal Raleigh. So do any of those jump out at you as like they really should be above? Like I feel like it's a kind of a fair grouping. It's more just like what do you want in a way?
I mean, maybe Tucker. Maybe we're digging him too much because he's been banged up so much. Like, think about the starts that Tucker got off to more so in 2024 when it was a longer before that shin injury. And even this year, the first month or so with the Cubs, it looked like he was like going to be an MVP candidate. And then it wasn't as clear of an injury, but he was banged up all year, essentially. Schwarber is interesting, but Nick Kurtz just seems like a young Kyle Schwarber in a sense, right? Like, so give me that there. Churio is also interesting too. I think in Roto and not in head to head, Churio might be a better play, but just because Kurtz is sort of one of those four categories, maybe four, one of them with a question mark with average, but I think at least he could be someone that doesn't hurt you with average there. So, not much for me not to like about Nick Kurtz.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I would go Schwarber slightly over, but okay, I think I like him over Churio and Tucker's. Tucker's a close one. Man, I still think, I guess when you look at Raleigh next to Kurtz, it's like you're trading off 20 points of batting average for
you're getting
position.
The catcher, right? Yeah.
Like that one, to me, there shouldn't be an 8-pick gap there. I think to me it feels more like it's a coin flip situation, but it'll be fun to watch all off season. To keep going into other topics, I mean, just general landscape observations that 13 outfielders went in the first three rounds, which was exactly the same as last year. So I think, Steve, what we talked about last year is that outfield kind of in a way thins out. You know, this past year, it was like if you missed out on outfield super early, it was like, you know, is Lawrence Butler your OF1? You know, Kwan was up higher last year. Then there was like, you know, Suzuki was at the end of that or at the beginning of that tier. And then like an Ian Happ was near the end of that, like pick 120. Any observations about outfield, like as a position,
I mean,
overall this year?
Our team's a perfect example. We were the last team to take an outfielder. I think that's right. And George Springer is our OF1. Which, if you just look at the back of the baseball card, there's not much not to like about that. And you look at George Springer's underlying numbers from this year alone, you're ecstatic. But the
fifth
last
round,
2 years also happened for George Springer. So, that kind of tells you where it is. It is another top-heavy position. But that being said, there are, you know, a lot of interesting options. Even beyond that, I like, say, Suzuki, you went with next round. Bellinger, also like Yelich. Kyle Stowers, another really interesting pick a little bit later. There's guys to like, but it definitely is top heavy as far as like OF1s. So if you do like, and a lot of those guys go in the first two rounds, right? Like,
you're right.
How many of those outfielders went in the first two rounds? 2, 4, 6, 8, 9. 9 in the first two rounds. So that's 9 of those, 13? In the first two. I know that sort of micromanaging it there and breaking down your
but you're right. Like, you got to
further.
You got to invest.
First round picks. Like, there's a lot of, like, it's like shortstops too in a way. It's right. Like your center fielders and your shortstops are, you know, going to be some of the best players in the big. So they go early. Mm-hmm. Maybe shortstop a little bit less so. There's less there, but you know, you need 3 outfielders. You only need 1 shortstop, really. So you got to think about it if you don't get an outfielder in your first 2-3 picks.
Mm-hmm. Because after that big wave, and we'll see if this is how the dust settles on ADP, but all those outfielders and up till Tyler Soderstrom, so like you mentioned, Bellinger, Suzuki, then there was like three or four rounds where only three or four outfielders went when everybody was loading up on pitching. So I don't know how much of that is just kind of like the nature of how this draft shook out. But I think it is something that it would be advised to jump in on outfield in the first four or five rounds. But it's probably like every year that you can't draft every single position. So you're going to have to pick one
that's
somewhere.
You need to pick one that's going to be maybe not a hole, but a little bit weaker than you want it to be, right? If you fill every spot and have a strength at every position, this would be an easy game, right?
That said, Steve, I think we did pretty good to go Springer and Suzuki after that. It feels like we have two outfield twos that I'd be super excited about. You know what I mean? So it's like, does that equal
and at an certain points, like, right, where definitely outfield ones, like George Springer from the All-Star break was like one of the best hitters in the bigs.
Yeah.
Say Suzuki until the All-Star break was one of the best hitters in the bigs and sort of fell off in the second half. So yeah. And on the year, both those guys' lines look great. And I think I would project them for somewhat similar, maybe a little bit of a more regression for Springer just because of his age and just how the last 2 years went, but clearly something changed with him, and I'm fine with that for where he went. I think the guy that we were considering right after him in Jackson Merrill, right? I think that's the opposite end of the coin, right? You could talk yourself into Jackson Merrill bouncing back and being a second round pick again, or you could say, hey, yeah, George Springer's just going late because of his age, and he was just that good.
Yep. Yeah, I'm excited to get into that one with Nick, because I feel like Springer, I know I was joking, is a fun flag plant and one to like make a debate for.
Yeah.
So,
Okay.
Well, we got a handful of other observations. We can kind of open it up and just talk about some fun names, but we're going to take our second ad break and we'll be right back after this. Okay, so Steve, not a area I hone in on every year, but maybe it's high time that I do pay more attention to relievers, because I've been in purgatory for all of our industry leagues in that like fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth place. But relievers is one that you have to kind of assess what the landscape's doing. This year, there were four relievers drafted between rounds 5 through 7. Last year, 9 relievers, the first 9, were drafted between 6 and 10. So to make some sense of the numbers, it's like there was a little mini bunch this year, I think 4 or 5 that were kind of pushed up that were a little bit pricier. And then last year, there was a bigger run in like the 9th and 10th round. This year, the run was more like the 11th and 12th round. So, you know, as that relates to actual pick numbers, it was like the shotgun blast for relievers really took off if you didn't invest early at pick like 125 instead of pick, you know, 105. So what do you make of the relief pitcher landscape this year when you look at, like, again, Eno Saris was kind of the brave one. He went Edwin Diaz in the 5th round, and then it wasn't until mid of the following round that Mason Miller went. Andres Munoz and Yoan Duran went in the 7th round, and then it was kind of a little bit of a wait before that next batch came. But thoughts on the relief landscape?
Another, you know, this isn't going to be a proxy for NFBC drafts, and I know Eno does more NFBC, so that's probably why he leaned there, and I'm not surprised that he was the first. Not saying that that's wrong, but that's just, you know, listening to Rates and Barrels every day and knowing what those guys do. That's not surprising. That would probably be my order of relievers. That being said, there was a headline today about Mason Miller that his role was uncertain for 2026, right? And that was sort of a hot button topic. Despite how good he was with the Padres when he first went over there, it's like, you know, maybe these guys gave up you know, Leo DeVries, who's one of the best prospects in baseball, for, you know, for some guy that they, not just some guy, but one of the best relievers in the game, but they may have grander plans for him in the rotation. It seems like they're, that window is at least slightly cracked, or door slightly cracked to that actually happening. But that said, I mean, yeah, those are, I think these are tiered properly, right? Like Diaz is sort of the old reliable, like, you know, volume wise, like, you know, guy that's going to be in the role and not even, like, you know, ever pitch like the eighth instead of the ninth, those sort of things. Like, he is the closer and, like, you know, probably the Vegas odds on leader for leading the league in saves. So I understand that. And, you know, he does just strike out the world too. So, cool, just career arc for him too, especially after his first year. That was a disaster in New York, and to just become like a, you know, but the best closer that there is in the true sense and definition of the word. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Miller, Duran, and Munoz, I think are a good tier. And then, you know, there's a bunch of guys that I like later on. We don't have a closer yet, but I think we've been considering it. But all those guys, you can't go wrong really with Hader, Chapman, despite his age, Cade Smith looked really good down the stretch. So there's a good amount of options, but obviously in NFBC, these guys will be bumped up much, mm-hmm. much higher.
I think I could see myself getting some shares of Munoz. I feel like he's not like the priciest one in the world, but it is.
And the skills are like on, like, you know, really as good as anyone, really, you know. There were some years where like he would get like 20 saves because like he came in and like a fireman, but now it's like, okay, he's the closer, capital C.
26 years close old.
To,
yeah, like
got he, close he, to 40 saves this year, right? Like, you know, once you sort of get to that threshold, like, this is soft analysis. Like, once you become a 40 save guy, it's like you're not really used like in other situations anymore, right? Like, you're like, that kind of happened to Diaz, right? A little bit, right? Like, you know, you got whatever, the 50 saves, and that was it.
You're just a lockdown.
Sort of there too. Yeah,
you're
exactly,
a lockdown closer. Exactly. Becomes part of your brand. He's 26 years old. He's
and
got
I think
the stuff. Like, and
part
he,
of the reason that probably
top
is,
dollar.
Too, because, you know, guys, teams want to keep arbitration costs down. And, like, once you get there, like, they go up, and, like, you're probably on, like, a free agent contract at that point anyway, right? So, you know, teams aren't afraid to use you in the ninth and mm-hmm. bump those numbers. It's dumb that it's stupid that's how it works, and
the
there's incentive
works.
To not to game sort of your player stats, but hey, that's the world we live in. But yeah, I guess one, you know, maybe that's a just a correlation or maybe an actual cause as to why that happens. But
yeah, 51% whiff rate on that slider for Munoz. Like, that's, you know, you love the guys that can strike out the world. Okay, so let's move over to second base, Steve, which you noted here is always thin. I was trying to look at numbers next to other numbers from past years. It's the same story. It's just some names have changed, right? Like Bryce Kerang has went in the fourth. We talked last week about Ketel Marte. On the third round, we were kind of looking at him late in the second round. But then there was a big long gap. We jumped in on Nico Horner in the seventh round. Then it's like Brandon Lau, Ozzie Albies, another few rounds. Like, it
lots
is
a question mark.
Super thin. And just like, is it a punt? Is it Ketel or punt? And, you know, Ketel, Terang, or punt, or did we do that wrong with Horner? Or do you find a little security that we got a, you know, bankable contributor at the position?
I feel secure there, and probably the last one that I feel super secure about, and like, okay, like Horner is going to give you plus average and steals. The power is not going to be great. I do like the Cubs offense, so the run should be there. He had 89 runs this year. Nice. So, you know, I think that's very projectable and sort of the last guy that I could do this for. As much as I like Brandon Lau, as good of a year he had, there's always rumors that he may get traded. There's always a chance that he's hurt. He played, you know, the most games that he played in, what, 4 or 5 years. I'll look that up real quickly. You know, I probably like his skills more just because he's, you know, a 30 homer player when healthy. You know, this was the first time that he played more than 110 games since 2021. Those 2 seasons last 2 years were good. He had 21 homers in 109 and 107 games respectively. But just, you know, that's not enough. You're not on the field enough. And he needs to be, someone that plays a lot, or else you're going to be trying to fill that thin position, with someone that's not going to be pretty on your waiver wire at second base. And he did miss some time too this year. He played 134 games, but it was the second most played appearance of his career at 553, compared to the 615 he had in 2021 when he had 39 bombs. So, yeah, I love the skills there, but I think Horner is more projectable and reliable. I kind of really want one of Marte or Turang.
I should add in, Steve, that Jazz Chisholm will have eligibility. Yes. He went at the end of the second round. And then in Yahoo leagues, yes, but NFBC, no. Mikel Garcia is another one that will carry the 2B there.
How many games did he have at second this year?
11.
Let's see. Okay, so yeah, you got that 10. So in leagues that have 10 category, appearances as a threshold. Good,
yeah,
but,
and yeah, Garcia,
you,
went,
for NFBC, you would hope, man, it would have been nice for him to get those 9.
So Garcia went middle of the 4th round.
Okay.
So right next to Bryce Turang. So there is a tax there, but I think we did it well, Steve. Like when you look at we went, the 3 hitters we took prior to Horner were Devers, George Springer, Saya Suzuki, and I think that when you have, you know, when you could use some speed, Horner does kind of check that box. Like if you're already good on speed, I don't know that it's worth adding that. But
we kind of went like well-rounded in Ramirez, Gunner, then more power heavy in Devers, Springer, and Suzuki. Although Springer does chip in some steals, you know, even though those years that were tough, he was still running. And then I think it was, to your point, it was a great balance to those fit. 3 picks right before him. Yeah, yeah.
For what it's worth, on Brandon Lau next to Horner, just on what they did this past season, Lau was a $14.40 player. Horner was $15.80. Okay. So like they just did what they did, Horner,
I mean, is we priced them. Good job, draft.
Yeah, we did it.
It was priced appropriately there.
Yeah, so
I mean, there was what? How many hitters between them? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 hitters. The rest are pitchers between them, you know?
Yeah, but I think you bring up a good point that you would probably say what Horner just did is more bankable than what Lau just did, right? In terms of, like, expectations and projecting out and everything, just in terms of durability. So,
and I guess on a per-game basis, like, Lau was more dollars per game, but he would need to play those games
to
get that, which
just
is
the availability.
A risky proposition for Lau.
All right, I think we can open it up. We can talk about how we liked our team, but were there any other, like, names or positions you wanted to like jump in on here, Steve?
What was your biggest shock, I guess, other than Caminero, of like the first 3 or 4 rounds?
I mean, this is always what I know. I talk about it that I kind of dig in and do research pick by pick, but I don't go into this draft with a crisp understanding of like how I view the landscape. Mm-hmm. So the surprise picks that come from other teams and names that pop up are always like, this is the first time when I start to realize, oh man, Nick Kurtz is an early second rounder. You know, Zach Neto is going early in the 4th round. Like just seeing some of the new names is interesting. In terms of like shock picks, I don't know. I mean,
I'm surprised Tatis is still a first rounder.
Yeah, that was surprising. I agree, because remember, we were on the second round, and I was like, we could go Tatis, and you're like, he's already off the board, and I'm like, oh man. I think it's interesting when you get to like round seven of the pitchers, and you start looking at like either the top end SP2s or the bargain bin SP1s to see like Kyle Bradish and Mizorowski there. Like those are just new names. And then it's like that whole next round. I will say that I think Logan Webb was underpriced again. Like we just saw another great year from him, and he went middle of the eighth round. Like that felt late to me going after the, you know, some of those names that we just talked about. I don't know, man. Logan Webb, when we talked about how you want a stable SP and it might get squeezed up earlier in the drafts, he's going after where we got like Nico Horner. Like that, you know, I think there's still a little bit of like the boring factor with Webb. So I might be back in there. But how about you? What sort of picks or trends jumped out and shocked you?
Yeah, I think the biggest for me, like Roman Anthony in the third. Not that that's bad or wrong. It's just, you know, it's one of those. That's, hey, cool to see it. Pecro Armstrong also in the third, right? Like mid season, we were like, you know, this is a first rounder. Like he just doesn't stop. But like, you know, I think we did say, hey, yeah, there should be some regression coming. I didn't expect that much to come in the second half, but like. You know, he like just got the 30 homers. He had like 25 and like it's what seemed like June, right? Or close to it. So I think it's properly priced, but like also kind of like goes to show like the roller coaster that happens in season a little bit.
What was up with Matt Shaw in the ninth round? I thought that felt early, like ahead of Isak. And Isak Paredes went, we were asking last episode where he would go, like him versus Trout, would he be 150? He went in the ninth round, so he was like pick 120, which is a bummer because I'm really hoping he is a discount for his injuries and everything. But yeah.
The middle of the fourth round makes me feel old. You can even bucket Jordan Alvarez in there, but. In a row, it goes Jordan Alvarez, Bryce Harper, Mookie Betts, Manny Machado, Freddie Freeman, Rafael Devers.
Third round.
Yeah, excuse me.
Dude, that's such a good call.
That's like the first round from like, you know, when like six, 7 years ago. Like, yeah.
Three years ago, I bet, right?
Yeah, probably.
That's so true.
But, it just makes me feel old. Seeing those guys who are perennial first rounders forever, in the middle of the third round. Not that they're bad picks. I kind of like all of those picks and all of those values.
Totally.
You know, I can see Betts definitely bouncing back after becoming an elite shortstop at his age, dealing with what he dealt with early in the season. With the trip to Japan and getting sick and losing all that weight and like kind of coming out, like he was pretty good the second half of the season. I know the overall line doesn't look great, but he was pretty good in August and September. I'll pull up some splits now, but you know, I could see some value there.
I'm looking at eligibility for Mookie as well while you're looking.
Yeah, he had 118 WRC plus in the second half. Hit 279, 342, 442 with a 784 OPS. So, still slightly disappointing, but, you know, his July and August his September, October was very much Mookie Betts-like, where he hit 299, 343, and slugged 547 with the 144 WRC plus, and that was on top of 115 WRC plus in August. So definitely looked like he was figuring something out in the last 2 months of the season there. So I could see Betts bouncing back.
It'll be age 34 season. But he's chasing Cooperstown. Is he already in?
Yeah. I think that's his. I don't know. I always thought of myself as a small hall, tough Hall of Fame guy, but I don't know. Maybe it's my fantasy brain or whatever. But yeah, like
we did this little exercise with that Ramirez's stats are actually better
with
J-Ram,
right?
Yeah. I think they're both.
I think he's in.
Yeah. Point being, he's such a good just baseball player that like he's not going to fizzle out. And to ask somebody to, you know, go through what he went through early in the season and it, like an off season could do him wonders, I guess is the point. Yeah. Right. So yeah, I think that's a good call as well. So what do you think of our team build, Steve? We had a super solid infield with Rafi Devers at first base, Gunner, or I should go in order here, Nico Horner at second base, Gunner at shortstop, Jose Ramirez at third. We went Springer, Suzuki in the outfield in rounds 5 and 6, and then jumped in on Kerry Carpenter in the 12th to round out the outfield. Did get Hunter Goodman in the 10th round. I really liked where that value was. And then, pitching staff looks like Brian Wu, Framber Valdez, Spencer Strider is kind of a boom bust there as the SP3, mm-hmm. Trevor Rogers, an exciting SP4, and then Sandy for some kind of stability with some upside there for the veteran there. But what do you think of the build so far?
I like it. It's well-rounded. Jose Ramirez is as steady as it comes. Like, talk about a guy that you can project his line right now, right? You know, 282, 29 homers, 32 steals, 100 runs, 100 RBIs, you know, book it. Gunner, I sort of talked about, like, I think that Gunner is still like one of the elite talents in the bigs. I think we talked about it last show or two shows ago. Like it's just, you know, there's more ground balls. Like there needs to be more fly balls, and who knows, maybe that oblique from early in the season messed with that and he could have been battling it all season. And this was just such a disaster season for the Orioles. I know that sort of snowballs. Devers, I love at first base. I think it's a great option. There's maybe some, I don't know. It's more of a discount. Maybe I guess, you know, because he's into a less hitter friendly environment in San Francisco from Boston, that whole drama, but you know, he has first base eligibility and I think he played. Does he have it in FBC? I'm pretty sure he does.
I think so.
I think he had more games there, but kind of love that.
29.
Yeah. So he's good. So he's good there. Yeah. Wu is an interesting SP1. Like, maybe I wanted one of those four pitchers, like, looking back at it. That would come at the sacrifice of what I think is a pretty strong start for hitters there. So, interesting. I see a lot of my teams being built like this. I mean, that's not surprising. We sort of have a mind meld on this now at this point with how long we've been doing this, but, I don't know. Kick it to you. What do you feel? How do you feel about like, would you be comfortable with, if this was a team where you had a lot at stake for?
Definitely comfortable. I think that's like the operating word. Is it feels like stable. Like you said, Wu is the ace. It is something we'll have to kind of defend and talk about. It's a little bit of a leap of faith, but I think we've all been waiting for that breakout. So to see it and then get him in that kind of middle of the pack for SP1s that you don't have to sacrifice a first or second round draft pick for, I can live with it. And then I think we, along with Samulski, have the no doubt best two infields in this league. Like Samulski's build first base was Vinny P, second base was Bryce Terang, shortstop was Ellie, third was Machado. That's the only other team.
And he's got Churio in there too. That's nice, but that comes at the expense of Carlos Rodon being his SP1.
Exactly. So, yeah. Like, I think then, and you know, we kind of round out the offense with, I think we did a great job like filling out our OF one and two. I think Goodman is, you know, to have a guy hitting third in Coors, the DH is 40 games, like that's underrated there. So I like our team a lot. I think, I guess I wish I was a little bit more excited about SP2 and SP3. You know, I'm a little burnt on the Strider thing. Like, it's hard for me to see the
Strider
upside
in year two from Tommy John. I make that bet. You know, I know it was so, so bad at certain points this year, but there was a few games down the stretch. It's like, all right, maybe starting to figure it out. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of all I need with the guy that has his upside, right? Like,
I would have felt great if we got Logan Webb in the eighth, like for reason, that versus Fromber. Like, we missed that by four or five picks. I think I would have pushed hard for that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's fun, man. I like this team. It's just fun. J Ram, dude, like, you got to tip a hat. It's just year after year. Like, how old
I mean,
is,
if you
is
he? If you look at Strider's game logs, like, it was pretty much three horrific starts.
Yeah, probably right when I got
in the middle of August.
Of
And then one of them was seven runs versus the White Sox, eight runs at the Mets, five runs versus Milwaukee. Other than that, he never gave up more than three runs. Or he did one. He did two times. So in June 3rd, and five runs, and on May 20th, he had four runs.
Yeah, six starts to close the year that he looked
good,
solid, but he just didn't strike out a ton of people. Like, it just didn't look like the same guy. But I know what you're saying, that he's still Strider, he's still 26, and he's got an off season for year two where we typically see better results. So yeah, I think you're right. There's an argument there, no doubt. I'll be curious if that's where that ADP will fall. So that's probably like 115 ish, somewhere in there. I don't know. And then Rodgers, we were talking about the whole second half, and we got him in the 11th round. I really like that one. So that kind of answered back well. So I like it, man. I'm excited to talk about it more when we get a chance to hop on with Nick.
I'm sure we'll touch on it in a few weeks when we finish up, and then be on the lookout. I think it comes out on the On a Corner stream, and I think we throw it on our feed as well too. So you'll be able to catch it. And it's always fun to break it down with Nick and get those seal of approvals. I think we'll have a few. I know he popped for a few of our picks there, so it'll be fun. Looking forward to it.
It's great. All right. Well, thank you guys for tuning in and joining us here as we look ahead for the first time to off-season draft landscape. But that wraps us up for episode 196. Coming up on 200, Steve. I misspoke.
Got to do something for that. Got to do something for that. Let's start a brainstorm.
Something special. That might be even a Christmas episode, the way a holiday episode. So thank you guys for tuning in. As always, thanks for talking baseball with us.
Thanks, guys.